So I think we're going to talk about poetry and get sentimental. How's that?
Great.
And then basically no one, well, a few people who listen to this, I made a whole Scooby-Doo thing about Faust. So I'm going to read from the very first stanza of Faust and just set the tone. What does our theater want today? What are our chances of success? To please the good old public I've elected, who live and let live, them I'd recreate. The boards are firm, the scaffold is erected, and open-eyed the people sit and wait. A rare dramatic treat is now expected. They take for granted that it's something great. I know my public, how it is impressed, yet feel, I must confess, my hopes receding. For even if they seldom see the best, the worthy folk go in so much for reading. How can we manage something brisk and new, not only smart but edifying too? For frankly, nothing pleases me much more than sight of crowds when they begin to pour wave upon wave at 3:30 or 4. Well, at our case, it's 5 o'clock. In daylight through our straight and narrow door, or when they shove and fight towards the wicket and nearly break their necks to get a ticket. you could go on. I mean, there's a
that's tremendous. It's I love the translation into the English doggerel of probably Pope, I guess. It is poetry. It captures a lot in a few lines. I mean, any criticism cannot. That's why he's great, man. I mean, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, that's why Faust is a classic. But just in general with poetry, you've written poetry, you've been engaged with people who are poetic.
Mm-hmm.
Off the top of your head, describe poetry.
Like I said, poetry just puts a lot into just a few lines.
Mm-hmm.
And I just realized listening to that, I mean, with this kind of very ironic galloping meter, right? It still gives you a lot of scenes in just like 10 or 11 lines, you know? So you get the intensity, the compression of it. I think that's all poetry is.
Compression. I mean, compression is definitely a big part of it, but also, isn't it, like, I keep struggling with this idea of maybe poetry. I mean, people constantly think poetry is in a struggle for meaning to defend itself, right?
Interesting.
Having the book.
That's quite an epigram. This is why we have this podcast, so Jonah can make these great epigrams.
Well,
a struggle for meaning to defend itself, and that's. It's kind of backhanded, but
yeah, of course.
But poetry just your head lights up, you know. That's all I can say. Your head lights up, and the last page of this book, Continental Reckoning. I mean, this guy's an historian, and he says, "A New Yorker attended a wake for a 1-year-old boy whose corpse stood at the center of the room, dressed in a spangled robe and crowned with a flowered wreath. Only the mother appeared to grieve. Beside her sat a blind fiddler, his eyes rolling side to side as he sawed away. A gay crowd drank rum and danced around the dead child, whose open eyes were cast slightly down as if he were deep in thought." That's poetry.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, boom. So good, so beautifully paced, so...
Wait,
I mean,
did you set up the context? What is the context?
This is on the Oregon Trail. This is a child that died on the Oregon Trail.
Okay. So, and they have rum?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the great scene in...
they have rum on the Oregon Trail?
Oh, yeah, the great scene in Berger's book and Dustin Hoffman's movie... What's it called?
Dustin Hoffman Oregon Trail movie? I've never seen it.
No, at the Custer's Massacre is the last survivor.
Oh.
What's it called? Anyway, we all know what it is. When the European Anglo-Saxon moves across the prairie, and when you meet a stranger in the prairie, you offer him a drink. Well, these are Indians. So he offers them a drink, and they take it and drink it, and within 5 minutes, they are tomahawking not only everybody, but each other too. They're so drunk, right? So yeah, there was always alcohol, and God, how could you cross the Oregon Trail without alcohol?
Well, man? Yeah. I mean, the weird thing with Indians and alcohol has to come down to their inherent state of mind. Like, they're kind of on edge all the time.
Yes.
And then you push that edge to a point, and then it exaggerates the edge.
Right. And it does, I mean, alcohol brings out my best parts, no doubt about that. I mean, we're talking about very violent people and right on the edge. And just give them two or four or five ounces of pure whiskey. Look what 4 or 5 ounces of pure whiskey does to me, man. I mean, geez, I can't believe it. How my sweet, normal nature, I just get kind of cranky at. But I don't mean it. I just kind of tell people I want them to act, and that's it, you know, and I don't do that unless I'm in that situation. But yeah, back to poetry.
That's, you want to act them to themselves or act against
them? Well, just like the other night, I mean, of course I did have a little fight with my squeeze, and she didn't show up, so I drank 2 IPAs instead of sharing one with her, and I go with her and she's not there, you know, and we're starting, and one of the band members just kind of, I start this song, and one of the band members like hits a, just kind of rakes it. He's electrified, and he just kind of rakes it. And I said, hey, Dave, man, you're not only fucking out of tune, you're playing out of rhythm. Are you going to play? Are we going to play or what? And everybody kind of looks at me, and then I just start playing. I mean, I'm over it, but it's only under the influence of alcohol do I lack that je ne sais pas smoothness, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I got a little Indian in me, you know. Well, I have Turkish in me, actually.
Everyone's got a little Indian in them.
Everybody has a little Indian in them. Yeah. That's exactly it, man.
The Indian in the cupboard, crawling into women's vaginas. Climbs up your pee hole. I'm the little Indian in ya. I'm here to inspire and also make your sex life weird. I'm the little Indian. Jesus, what the fuck is this? What the fuck is...
You're on your second beer, man.
No, I'm more than that. My crazy friend came into town, and... Yeah,
your crazy what?
My crazy friend. My dumb... Stanton. My dumbass friend. He came into town.
What's he doing now?
Oh, God. He's with a woman 30 years older than him.
In Ketchum?
Yeah.
And he's still with her.
Yeah, and then her father was dying, so he's going into hospice. So they came into town, and he can't deal with it emotionally because he's just a child who wants a mother consistently. And,
Stanton is a writer. We have to tell the audience.
Well, he's
and he has published books, and he is a writer.
Well, published is a very generous term.
Yeah, but anyway, when he was so outrageous that even Jonah would say, "Hey, Stanton, come on, man." And he would say, look, I'm a writer. This is justification for any type of...
Yeah.
That's why I want to be a writer, because you can act like a total asshole.
I mean, and maybe that's part of being a poet, too, right?
But this is so wonderful, because Stanton burned this lady's house down, her million-dollar house in Ketchum, and she still loves him.
Yeah.
Love conquers all.
Well, also, it worked out in the positive for them, because... They got, more than their fair share back in insurance to rebuild it. So,
one wonders whether Stanton is going to oversee the architectural designs.
He should be signed on for the new architectural build of the dam that the Republicans want to tear down. And be like, well, we'll design a new one, aka we'll just get rid of the old one. he's so stupid. It's so stupid, but it makes me laugh. the things that make me laugh are just the stupidest things. Like, I think it's maybe because I'm just in a hybrid. Like, I want to think of myself as a highbrow person. I want to think of myself as, like, taking things seriously when they're able to be taken seriously.
You're living at a higher register than normal people.
Maybe, maybe. And but Stanton, and just the stupidest things make me laugh so much.
Right.
I laugh so much when someone's just saying nonsense.
Right.
Like, when someone's just talking to me and they're just saying nothing at all and it's just nonsense, it makes me laugh.
Of course. It's one of the great joys of life. those of us who write at such a high register.
But it also makes me feel like I'm stupid. Like, I'm like, well, I think I'm smart, but this is the thing that amuses me. Maybe I'm just an idiot.
No, in your heart of hearts, you're a caretaker, Jonah. I see Stanton coming. It's like, I turn off the lights, man. It's like, I'm just kidding. Just kidding,
Stanton. No, yeah.
Just kidding, Stanton. Come in the story.
He's not going to listen. He's not gonna, don't worry about that.
Oh, my Lord.
But I guess this is the weirdest segue of all time, but I brought one of my my diagnosed schizophrenic friend's poetry books,
mm-hmm.
and I was going to read a piece of his poetry because I thought it was it's actually kind of good. Like, hey, it's
we're going to go from Goethe to a schizophrenic.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah, all the
from a classical, you know, style.
This is the continuum of poetry.
This is a continuum.
Yeah, yeah. Goethe and then schizophrenia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Entropy.
But also E. E. Cummings. So I read this one the other day, which is late stage E.E. Cummings, and it's hard to even describe if it's a poem or not, but to me it's almost like a, like, E.E. Cummings was a Brit, right?
No, he was a Boston Brahmin. Boston, New York Brahmin, yeah. Came from a long, old, rich line.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was published, The one thing in this was he was published by Horace Liveright, and Horace Liveright was a Jew living in London.
Right. But all the so-called modernist avant-garde writers from America were published, like Hemingway and Joyce and E. Cummings, and in France or England because of the obscenity clauses in the United States federal laws, right?
Yeah.
So, as you know, Ulysses was banned in America, and it was the judge who said it wasn't, right?
There and was also a, being there, banned is not bad for your reputation.
No, yeah. but hey, listen, Joyce could not get published in Ireland, definitely, and couldn't get published in. Of course, he ran into. It's a great story. He ran into the ladies at Shakespeare and Company, but people don't realize that. You know, like Winesburg, Ohio, by Sherwood Anderson, that's so great. I mean, yes, there are some murmurings, but there's no really explicit language or explicit sexual things at all. It's all totally under the, you know, it's an undercurrent, and that's why it's so good, right?
Hmm.
But anyway, E. Cummings is old money, northeast money.
Okay, well, that's more than I knew about him, but. I was just looking through his book of poems, and there's one I just really like. He, first of all, he does away with all the capitalizations, and mm-hmm. you know, it's like there's a lot of these freeform poets that I feel like have kind of been bad for poetry. I'm almost on W.H. Auden's side of, like, if you're really going to be interested in poetry, you should be interested in the rhyme structure. You should be interested in linguistic games. And, but at the same time, there is...
Poetry is not typography. It should not depend on the typography on the page.
Yeah.
And it, you know, so if you read it, the reader doesn't, anyway, like I say, I believe that too, you know. I mean, it's, but everybody gets into, you know, poetry and language as a text on the paper, right? And so you can put all these spaces in and all these things through spacing. And so I've never liked it either.
So you think E.E. Cummings, that's what he was doing, was, well, because inevitably he was poetry using, is language, right? It's the
right
way it sounds in your head.
So in Just Spring, when the world is puddle luscious and Mary and Isabel come dancing and it's spring and the little lame balloon man whistles far and wee. Great poetry, right? That's a whole page. I mean, his spacing. Or it's at least a half a page.
Who is that?
E.E. Cummings.
That's E.E. Cummings? You have a memorized E.E. Cummings poem?
That's a great poem.
Yeah. In Just Spring. I'm sure it's in here somewhere.
And the little lame balloon man whistles far and wee. I mean, it's just great poetry, man. And, yeah, I grew up with that stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, and so why should I criticize it? Because... if he just would have put it in lines, you know, like a haiku, it would have been just as good to me, but yeah. I still see it there. And he even capitalizes the just, you know, I can just see it in Just Spring as an accent.
Well, that's the benefit of keeping everything not capitalized, right? Is when you do want to capitalize something, but, you know.
Exactly so.
Yeah.
So I hadn't thought of that. That's absolutely right.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if anyone who ever listened to this podcast would know this, but I'm more of an idea guy. But so there's one in E. Cummings' 100 poems. When serpents bargain for the right to squirm, and the sun strikes to gain a living wage, when thorns regard their roses with alarm, and rainbows are insured against old age. When every thrush may sing no new moon, in if all screech owls have not okayed his voice, and any wave signs on the dotted line, or else an ocean is compelled to close. When the oak begs permission of the birch to make an acorn, valleys accuse their mountains of having altitude, and March denounces April as a saboteur, then we'll believe in that incredible, unanimal mankind, and not until.
It's a great poem.
He's like,
so I told you he's Northeast Brahmin.
Yeah.
But he makes a good point, and I agree with him completely. I mean, I agree with the poem. You know, that's just what we're talking about. Is that, you know, the politicalization of literature, I hate it. Literature is the one thing I've got to love because of its freedom. Mm. And, man, when they do gender studies and gender approaches to Melville and everything, man, I just hate it. You know, yeah. It's like, fuck you.
'Cause that's
We've been it. Through this, Jonah. Yeah. Sorry, so I'll quit right now. But yeah, that's what he's saying, because it was back then, you know.
Yeah.
Let's make literature just nice and cute and easily formulated, you know. Fuck it, man. So I think that's what he's saying, but.
Well, yeah. But how?
And anyway, it's a beautiful rhythm, beautiful poem, great images, and the rhetoric. If you're talking about poetry as rhetoric, that's a brilliant rhetorical, you know, piece. You know,
well, I think maybe that's my affection for it is. The idea of poetry as being rhetoric, of like its capacity to say something rhetorically that nothing else ever could.
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is doubly rhetorical. And this is rhetorical. And he's just saying, yeah, I'm just saying this, you know. So yeah, it's got a double trump of I hate to fuck. We can't use the word Trump anymore, man.
No, yeah.
Yeah, what are we going to use?
That's.
But nobody plays bridge anymore, so what the heck.
I still play whist.
I love whist, and I love bridge. We got to play some cards, man. God, it's so great. So in whist, are there four players?
Yeah.
And is there one guy that lays the cards down and is the table?
Yeah. Well, I've
just always playing. Like that when I had a hand, I could
just
lay it down and then go have a drink, do my bits and then go drink. Yeah.
It's a good part of cards.
I love bridge, man. That's still the best. It's such a genteel game, man. So much fun.
I mean, who came up with the idea of cards? Like the where does that come from? Oh, I mean, God. if we had an answer to that.
Oh gosh.
I mean, I'm sure it's on the internet.
I don't know.
Things you can look up on the internet.
I don't know.
Okay, let me throw another.
Okay, that will be our next one. What is the origin of
cards?
Of cards and the coding
and
the symbolism.
That should have been on our meditations.
But it all comes out. But it all comes out of the, the hermetic idea of hierarchies. You know. Aces, kings, queens. Once you get ideas of hierarchies, and then you subdivide them and mix them, you get some incredible stuff. And we know that that's how computers ended up, you know.
Well, we know that.
I do.
Yeah, that's how computers ended up.
Well, I'm on my second IPA, so I'm getting these visions. But yeah, it's all about hierarchies of meaning. You develop hierarchies of meaning, and then you subdivide them, and then you transcross them. You get incredible subtleties of meaning.
Yeah, but I think there would be some argument that that's the opposite of how computers work. Computers are literally the base digits of ones and zeros.
But they create...
continuously executed.
They create hierarchical patterns, though.
No. No, that's the whole point of... They
really?
Don't.
Really?
They don't create hierarchical...
Really?
Hierarchical... I'm glad that made you laugh.
because the readership knows how often he corrects my pronunciation.
Okay. Anyway.
We got another poem?
Yep. This one's esoteric. When God decided to invent everything, he took one breath bigger than a circus tent. And everything began. When man determined to destroy himself, he picked the was of shall, and finding only why, smashed it into because. That's it. That's the poem. It's really fucking hard to parse. I like it.
That's that play, the last word, and smash it into because. I mean, Cummings, rightly so, is a critique of the cognitive, comprehension of this glorious reality that we live in. You know,
smashed is
It's beautiful, man. I love it.
When man determined to destroy himself, he picked the was of shall. And finding only why, smashed it into because.
It's brilliant, yeah.
Do you think he's brilliant in that moment when he writes that, though? How does he think of himself when he writes it?
I don't know. I just know that E. Cummings was like one of the top two or three poets living. Into the time I grew up. So I was born. I started reading in like 1965, right? And through the 40s and through the 30s, 40s and 50s, he maintained his presence. And
let's imagine today. How
so can... I'm just saying that you're telling me these are later poems.
Yeah.
This guy is famous.
Mm.
So the temptation is to write these fucking oracular poems, right? And that's what that is, and I like it, and you like the succinctness of his critique, right?
Yeah.
Of the cognitive you know, just like when people say, okay, well, the universe is infinite. Well, where are we going to go from there, right?
Yeah.
And so I like his critiques. I like his writing. I'm just saying that here's a guy who's famous, who knows that a very large of the reading public of America is waiting for his books, right?
Mm.
And I think you write differently when you do that.
Well, to me, it just makes me question, like, how could any modern person take, like, when I first started writing, I remember reading, like, there will be a million poems published in various journals this year. A million. So how can you possibly expect to know or look through all that stuff and know what's good or what isn't? It's all just individuals expressing their consciousness to some extent or another. At least E.E. Cummings is doing something of, like, trying to encapsulate a larger grand scheme of how lots of people think, which I think poetry should try and do.
I disagree. I mean, I just like to write, you know. And as you know, one out of every five people that come in here write poetry, and that's why I love this place so much. I mean, and they write good stuff because the human spirit loves to use words, and like the great man said, the unconscious is structured like language, and that means chaos.
Isn't it?
That means chaos, and that means tremendous beauty. These young women have read me poems that are really good. They're just as good as what E.G. Cummings just read right now, you know? And I just think it's wonderful. I think it's a flowering, and the problem is that we don't have zines anymore. I mean, nobody's really publishing ink and paper stuff. And
well, yeah. I mean, the flowering, to use your metaphor or analogy.
How about fluorescence?
Oh, well, I like flowering better because it's something that exposes itself for a minute and then fades away.
You're right, man.
Fades away.
You're
so fast.
Right, man.
Yeah.
That old pistol, that, like, gold little furry pistol right there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely,
yeah.
Man.
It's basically sex. I mean, it's a...
Well, poetry is the human being's communion with the infinite, you know, with these, you know, these...
Well, at its best, but...
Yeah, it's always that way, and that's what I mean, a lot of young people come in and read their stuff to me, and it's the individual communing with the infinite, with infinite pain, awe, usually pain, but awe, and I mean, it's great. You know, and then there is the Goethean or the Popian style that is very intellectual, or the E. Cummings style that's very intellectual. But to me, it's just all expression. It's just part of being alive. I think it's really glorious, man.
Yeah, but how does it... yeah, but like that million number sticks in my head of, like, it's stuck in my head for 20 years now. Like, how do you convince yourself that any of this is worth any... You know, you can talk to... You can go out to the bar and talk to 1,000 people. Everybody's got a story. I mean, it's basically the same thing. Like, writing a poem, this is my little story.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Well, you know...
I actually don't see poetry as a story. I don't see poetry as a story. I see it as a participation in the mystery of being... having an identity... having this space and time, right, and being lost there and expressing all this awe and terror, you know, that's what most of the people that I read, that's mainly what they're saying. And And yeah, I mean, is some how many of them are like Yeats going to go through the work to pace these poems and give them power, you know, and music and dramatic effect, right? None of them are. It's true. But, you know, if somebody is doing that, they might not get published either. But at least they're going through the evolution of taking their amorphous, you know, cries and creating drama out of them. I think the greatest poetic piece is Oedipus by Sophocles. I mean, it's just this poem of, you know, exhilarating power. It starts with that kind of loss and that ambiguity, right, and that confusion. And with every line, it like starts becoming sharper and sharper, and the intensity of the beat gets tighter. And man, pretty soon you just can't handle it anymore. It's like so goddamn powerful. So I see Oedipus Rex as a poem, you know.
Yeah. Oh.
And but the skill required to reach that level, where you involve the reader, the participant, the audience, into what you're doing, that's a whole lifetime, man. You know, so I accept your critique. There are a million poems a year. How many of them have that moral and aesthetic commitment to really do something spectacular, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, how do you come to terms with that commitment? Like, how do you even allow yourself to be committed to that? That is a completely different question. It's like it's like being committed to a rock or something. Like, you're like, I'm gonna get engaged to this piece of moss, and everyone's like, what? Why? You're like, well, I don't know. It's kind of like encapsulates the universe, man. It's like it's got all the functions.
Right, fractally, moss and algae on a rock are spectacular, man. Yeah, if you look at every thing, well, that's what great artists do. I think that's the essence of, if you want me to ask, the essence of great poetry, great art, great music, commitment to detail, and the possibilities of the image, you know.
Yeah.
That's poetry, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because, yeah, I see poetry as music, painting, dance, when it has that attention to detail with a structure that drives towards something really powerful. That's what I like.
Mm.
I was listening to Sibelius' Second Symphony this morning, man. I was going, man, good old Gene up there in Finland.
This is what I don't do. I never accidentally listen to symphonies. This is hopefully with age I'm going to get to your point where I'm accidentally.
Oh, I don't either. I don't either. I just turn it on, and driving from the thrift store where I buy my books, it comes on automatically, and I'm listening. I'm going, I know who did that. Is it Tchaikovsky? And I thought it was, but it was Sibelius. I was astounded, man.
Hmm. Sibelius. that was me killing time.
And here Joan is, Norwegian and Swiss, but he's got no Finnish in him.
I don't think I do. Yep. So I'm going to read to you something from my friend's poetry book. He started smoking too much weed when he was 19.
So we're going to end this podcast with a schizophrenic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, if I read all the different parts, it would get boring, but there's this one section of maybe 10 lines here that I think is like encapsulates how schizophrenics are actually geniuses of understanding certain human dynamics of there's like a lot of other bullshit on top of it, but okay, so he sets up this series of there's a cartographer, an artist, and a manager. Anyway, it goes like this: to be taught by a fool hardly sounds kind. but the artist has words to place in your mind. We think in our head. Do we choose what to think? If so, we are choosing what not to think. Think. Kind of a Dr. Seuss kind of thing. A man sees an object, hears the word of the thought. Pops into his brain as he walks down the block. The object is past. The word, it remains in his mind. It is fast as his thinking is played by the object itself. It sits on the shelf of his mind. He decides what to do with that rhyme. The object stirs memory, something long lost, a memory of choosing to pay a dear cost. The choice was before him. He chose, and he paid. Now the memory of paying remains thought displayed. Does he choose to remember, or was it a choice? If he didn't so choose, then what chose for the voice in his head to remember? Was it himself? Who else could it be? This is not mental health. Or is it, you see? Reaction. An argument. Vision. A fight between two. A woman. A man. The fight it is due. They vocalize sides. One on one their horse rides like the tide. Their tongues twist. Back and forth their piece hides. Simple, that is. A character takes. A side against thoughts. Another replaced. In that other's own brain, two sides, yes, two sides. Valid is the fight when characters collide.
It's fantastic.
I thought it was a good, you know, set of sentences.
But what's wonderful, I mean, you do go into the topology of a schizophrenic.
Yeah. He doesn't hide that. Yeah.
It's spectacular.
Yeah.
No, it's really wonderful, man.
You watch that thought, it sits on a shelf. And then the fight.
And then to join it to this English doggerel, I mean, it's really, and there's a little jazz in it. No, it's really spectacular, man.
Yeah.
So, yeah, my point is made. It's really wonderful this guy wrote that. One of a million poems, you know. And you know he suffered and worked hard on it, man. Because the rhythms are really nice. So what's his name?
Sam Caton.
Sam Caton.
Yep.
Well, here's you, Sam.
Yeah.
You get to end our podcast on poetry.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy.
So he lives in Pokey, or?
No, he lives in my hometown. He lives in North Dakota.
Well, this is great. Sam, you are now going to become famous.
No,
featured on Western Thought.
Yeah.
On
we're so famous.
February 25th, 2000.
Last time I looked at new books, they were like all coming out of Brooklyn, and they're all self-congratulating themselves, patting themselves on the back. I'm like, you know, is it just like a thing in Brooklyn? Like, you publish something this month, and then every other writer and artist in Brooklyn gives you money, and so then you get the money for that month, and then that boosts you up, right. And then you have to give money to the other artists. Like, that's like.
It's a Ponzi scheme.
Well, it's, art is a Ponzi scheme. Art is a Ponzi scheme of ourselves. That's what I should call this podcast. Art is a Ponzi scheme of ourselves.
Hey, I think it's great, man. I mean, that's just how it works. I mean, I've got all the books written about the Beats is because they all wrote about each other and adulated each other.
Yeah.
Justifiably so.
Well, also, it was, like, different. I mean, like, the beginning of Kerouac's Subterraneans begins with him talking about how we could all talk about Ezra Pound and no one would be pretentious about it. You know, it's kind of like, we're cool, we, like, understand
which
stuff.
What a great support for what I just said.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds just like 15-year-old kids talking about how cool we are. We can talk about Ezra Pound without sounding pretentious. Well, actually, I think Ezra Pound's really mediocre. So, but there I am being pretentious.
Yeah.
Darn, man, we got to cut this short, man. I got to cut up the hill.
All right. Well, cutting it short isn't always a bad thing.
No, it's not. No. It's not.
Well, unless you want to say something.
But no, this is great. No, it's.
I felt like I talked too much.
It was perfect, man.
Okay.
You're just going to have to edit out my adulation of the last 30 seconds.
Yeah, but as a self-hating.
I'm glad you read that piece by Sam, man. I mean, it's really good. You're experiencing his thought patterns.
Yeah.
Because he's worked really hard to reproduce them. I mean, that's poetry.
Yeah. Perfect.